Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. You know, we put our money into investments, whatever they are, because we believe there's a strong probability that we're going to get rewarded for doing so, and therefore will add to our wealth. But all too often, we do this with more emotion than logic than we realize. We get drawn in by enthusiasm, by FOMO, by confirmation bias, the recency bias, rather than making what we believe are purely rational decisions. Our guest today is, to me, one of the most intriguing and interesting people we've happened across in the world of investing in a long time. Like many of you, I've been around the investment business for decades, and one of the most fascinating things about this business that I realized year after year and have come to love is that just when you think you've gotten to know this business, gotten to know something, gotten an edge, so to speak, you come across people and ideas and knowledge that make you realize there's so much more you didn't know you didn't know. Chris Abdelmessier, an absolute icon in the options market making and commodity trading world and realm, is here. For those of you unfamiliar with his work, Chris spent over 20 years trading options, starting with an 8-year stint at Susquehanna or SIG, followed by 4 years at Parallax Advisory. And today, Chris is busy with his own startup, Moontower, and publishes extensively at his Moontower Substack. If you take a moment to sample Chris's writing and other podcast appearances, you'll find out what I mean when I say there's so much you didn't know you didn't know. Today, we're going to talk about Chris's career, poker, among other things, prediction markets, and trading and making markets in options.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Chris, welcome. It is truly terrific to have you on the show.
Pierre, thanks for having me on. That was overly generous. Thank you very much. I just want to make one quick correction. After SIG, I spent 4 years with my own shop, and then I spent 8 years with Parallax, but just so not create any confusion.
Oh, right. I think.
But no, that was overall, though, that was an overwhelmingly generous introduction. Thank you.
I felt like, you know, I felt like I had come across, you know, someone who really wants to help investors, help people who are interested in options. But really, I think the part about helping investors is really like, you know, pulling back the curtain on things that, you know, unless you've been around it, like the options trading world, the market making world, you know, for me, it was always sort of this, you know, sacred place, like the trading pits. You know, you see it in movies, you see it on, you know, Wall Street, you see it in, the movie Wall Street, but you see it everywhere, like trading places, you know, that sort of fascinating place where people are shouting at each other and hand signaling and taking orders and, you know, buy, sell, right? I think, you know, it's fascinating, but it was kind of, it's just sort of like a shrouded place as well, right? It's not really something, and the people who are in the business don't really make an effort to talk about what they do or how it works or why it works the way it works. And so it's sort of a mysterious place, maybe not shrouded, but mysterious. I mean, you can go and, you know, there's a lot of history on this particular subject, but I've always found it intriguing and mysterious and fascinating. And I felt like, you know, you're really doing your part to sort of pull back the curtain or unveil, you know, some of the truths that you picked up over the, you know, your lengthy career. And I'm sorry, I recall that you launched your own commodity trading operation after being in the Pittsburgh. I do want to talk about that. We are gonna touch on that. But I think the best place to start, Chris, and again, thank you again for being here. I'm really excited about our conversation. maybe, Chris, talk about, I think to begin, talk about your beginnings and how you wound up at Susquehanna. How did that happen? How you got into trading options in the first place?
Sure. When I was at Cornell for undergrad. I was mostly like, as a lot of people are, young people are, I was, didn't really know what I wanted to do for first couple of years. I switched majors a bunch. I tried computer science for a week and couldn't even get a coding environment set up. This is 1996. I didn't have a computer, so I would go to the computer lab and try to, and I remember the first assignment, I couldn't even get through that. So that was, I dropped computer science. I think it was Java was the language that they were teaching back then. And
right.
I dropped that. I tried sociology for a little bit. I tried psychology was probably the one I stuck with the most. And then I landed on economics. And to be honest, economics, I picked that for two reasons. One, it was kind of, I did find it somewhat interesting. Probably not any more interesting than I thought psychology was, but it was more that it had the least requirements to get the degree. And at this point, I had almost been in college for 2 years and hadn't settled on a major and figured I better pick something I'm actually going to finish in 4 years. So, which is all to say that I was a fairly lazy and unmotivated. And I think that's, I don't think that's my nature. It's probably, it's just that I didn't know what I wanted to do. So when you're unfocused, it's easy to just kind of float in the wind a little bit there. So once I got into the major, I eventually took futures and options kind of course. I actually really enjoyed that. And it also, I had also spent some time in the summer working at a bank. So I got exposure to what some of these words were that were in that class that were at the bank. And I didn't really understand what was happening at the bank and had a very menial sort of job there. But overall, that's what kind of got me interested. It just, so there was a stroke of luck involved because I ended up, I took that futures and options course. So in Cornell, there's a hotel school, and it was weirdly that class was like in the hotel school. It was an investment class, so a 300 level investment class, and the professor liked me, just because, you know, I was asking questions and stuff like that. And the professor asked me to be the head teaching assistant for the class the next semester.
Wow.
It's still like, I just look at this thing as just pure stroke of luck. Like, there was no reason he should have asked me to do it other than like, I just seem interested in it. And yeah, maybe I was there. I don't know. Like, you hang around the rim in life sometimes. Something happens. So I was given that responsibility. I'll take a responsibility seriously. So I said, okay, I better be ready. And he asked me if I would lecture in front of the class for 15 minutes of the 75-minute lecture twice a week. So this is 1999, around then. And so
right.
The dot-com stuff was all kind of going crazy. And this was the first, like, day trading was becoming the hotness. And this was the first, you know, probably this was a little bit before those E-Trade commercials with the baby, but the whole like for online brokerage was becoming a thing, TD Ameritrade, all that. And so I would go and I would research some idea, whatever was going on in the market that day. And then I would just go make up something to talk about that related it to whatever we were doing in the class.
Right.
So I started doing that, and then this is kind of and then that kind of generated you're doing that, you're getting positive feedback for doing that, and so then you start to identify yourself with the thing that you're getting positive feedback back, like you're almost getting hacked yourself by like the mirror. So
right,
I'm like, oh, I'm a markets person. It's completely like, you know, irrational like thought, because it's just based off of this like feedback. But any case, you start to feel that way. And so I said, maybe I should be in trading. And then when I went to the career fair there was, I saw there's different firms, lots of I didn't want to go into investment banking because I heard those hours were 100 hours a week. That sounded crazy to me. So, but then there was a booth and it turned out to be Sig's booth. And there was just a guy sitting there with he had cards and dice. Right. And that struck me as, well, that looks like fun. Let me go talk to this guy. Well, he actually kind of pulled me over. He saw me standing there kind of like a lost fawn or something. And so I went over and I started talking to him, and he just, I don't remember exactly what he asked me, but it was like some kind of, question related to the dice or whatever. And soon enough, he gives me the impression that trading is just playing a game. And I like games and thought that sounds like fun and it's markets related and all that. And so that was really, I did an interview right there. They take you kind of back, do an interview. And that was first round. The crazy part of the story maybe is that I really didn't do very well on the interview. They asked me three probability-esque type questions. I got them all wrong, if I remember correctly. And, but I asked him at the end of the interview, I asked him, I really actually like this stuff, and I don't think I did very well here, but could you tell me what I could go learn, what I could study so that I could improve myself? And he gave me a book he told me the name of a book that, it was David Sklansky's Getting the Best of It. And he said, if you go read that book, that's, especially the first chapter of that book, that's a lot of what we care, that kind of stuff. And turned out that I ended up getting a call back for the second round, and all the questions basically came out of the first chapter of the book. So he gave me the answer key. So I figured, I guess he liked me. But that was really sort of the story, which was kind of navigate, went from I had no idea what I want to do to randomly finding something that kind of resonated. And then, of course, you don't know, from that point, you don't know what's going to turn out, but it turned out to be work that I enjoyed.
Amazing. I just sort of realized, that you call it a stroke of luck, but I think you had two strokes of luck, right? I mean, your curiosity in your futures options class at Cornell got you, that responsibility granted to you by the professor to do that 15-minute lecture every week, which made you which motivated you, right? It motivated you to fulfill that responsibility. So you went from being sort of like, I don't know what I want to do, to being a market person. But then your curiosity at the job fair ignited that conversation about your interview, your desire, but about, the book and the chapters. So that's, for anyone that's looking, for anyone that sort of like just graduated or looking for a direction, what to do, if you find something that interests you, don't be afraid to express your curiosity. I think it's very easy, especially with younger men and women today, social interaction is at I feel like social interaction in that age cohort is at an all-time low, right? They're so people are so into their devices, young, kids today are into their phones and they're just, communicating. There was this thing with Scott Galloway I watched the other day. He was interviewed by Ben Stiller.
Okay.
And he said that, 45% of young men have never asked a woman or young girl, a girl their age, out on a date in person.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's happening for 20 something kids today on their phones. They've lost that live human interaction. But anyways, I think I that's kind of what I got out of what you your story of how you ended up at Susquehanna. Which is that your in-person curiosity, not just an email or a letter or applying for a job, that opportunity that you had to actually interact with folks, whether it was your professor or at the job fair, is what created demand for you.
Yeah,
that guy's interesting.
I'll just insert some, just a comment. This is like, you know, kind of might be a, just because you brought this up, you mentioned about the social interaction being at an all-time low. So I have two sort of like pet questions that I tend to ask any professor yeah. or teacher that I ask, that I meet these days. But it's kind of because of this idea. I ask them if they've noticed any change in their student, like if they've been teaching for a long time, if they notice any change in students. I always leave it pretty open-ended because I try not to, you know, I don't want to lead the witness in any way.
Right.
So I just ask them, have they noticed any change in the last few years with kids that are in their classes? And that is the answer I get back from teachers and professors immediately is, the students don't look each other in the eye. And they said it really accelerated after COVID.
Right.
So right. It's just something that I point out because I think some like, it's funny because I never like went into the research of like what Scott Galloway's talking about. I don't know any of the percentages, but it's just something that I have asked teachers and professors whenever I meet. It's like the first thing, anytime you tell me you're a teacher or professor, the first thing I ask you. And the other one I sometimes ask about though is have they noticed any change in their students' ability to read?
Wow. That's what a great question.
Yeah. It's just the whole like you know, the device thing. It's I have my children are 9 and 12 and you know, it's like we're part of that, like, you know, no phones till high school thing. And
that's wonderful. That's an awesome rule.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. You know, my eldest is he's in seventh grade right now, and we'll see what eighth grade starts to look like. But yeah, we're seeing more of his friends get the phone, and the issue isn't like it's always a social it's a social issue, right? Because it's if they don't have the phone and all their friends have the phone, and they're kind of like left out, right? So
right.
It's trying to balance this. I mean, that's why. You have to do it as like the families have to do it as a community. Like we all agree, you know, we have to collude. So,
yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem, right? Is that day in and day out, you know, you're not specifically your kids, Chris, but your kids are going to come home and say, oh, so-and-so got this. I want one too. You know, I want a phone too. I want a new notebook computer. I want a new whatever device, you know, is hot, but obviously it's the iPhone. It's any kind of phone that they can stay in touch with. You know, I like our kids and, you know, Joseph and I, like our kids are in their 20s. Joseph's son just graduated. We've always like been really hard pressed to socialize them, like to make them more social, like engage them in conversations, make them put their phones down. But you know, it was sort of like for us, because our kids are older than yours, you know, now that the cat's out of the bag, you just sort of like, wow, what a mistake that was, introducing, you know, young children to technology too early. And so very interesting questions. I love it. I mean, I love that because, so what was the response? What kind of responses are you getting about the reading question?
It's crazy because I think it's a little disheartening because whenever I ask those questions to a teacher, they immediately switch on. They immediately react because they're like, it's super impactful to them. It's very, very salient, the difference. So that every time it's like, oh yeah, this is like falling off a cliff. Like, and it's from honest, it's to both questions. These things have fallen off a cliff, which is like, you know, like I said, like we've kind of read about these things online, but you know, it's always interesting to just ask a teacher to ask a teacher what they've experienced like sort of over the years. Because they're in it every day. And yeah, so it's just, you know, and I don't, I don't know, the car, you know, it's like, that's, this is a lot of the whole, like, Jonathan Haidt stuff, which has become very famous for talking about these things and what the devices are doing to us and all that. So, you know, I think causality is super hard, but, you know, it's hard to not think that the devices have anything to do with it. I mean, look, we all do it ourselves. Like, we're not modeling the best behavior either. I mean, I'm on my phone, human, and I'm on my phone a lot. And so, we're not modeling the best behavior. So you have to be really conscious because, you know, the most addicting sort of like technology in the world is like in your hands. And
right.
Unfortunately, I mean, let's be honest, like, you know, I was a bored kid growing up and like lots of people are bored when they're sort of younger and you put something like you put the internet in somebody's hands and, you know, you're going to make boredom go away pretty quickly. So
yeah,
it's a, you know, you're combating something that is, I mean, you almost stands, no match against it. And, you know, to require people to be bored is, you're going uphill. Like, I think that's probably a good thing to do, but you're going uphill for sure.
But if I get going on the subject of, you know, what it was like to be in high school and in college in the 80s and 90s, you know, when you had to write a research paper, you know, you had to go to the library, you had to go through subject cards, like manually go through subject note cards in the stacks at the library. You had to go and find the book, you know, you had to do all this manual stuff. And then you had to actually read the book.
It was like the microfiche.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember writing a big term paper on Charles Darwin in high school and just like, you know, being in the library for days.
Or you know, if you had assigned a reading, you know, a reading for English class, you had to read the book. You actually had to read it. You know, like, sure, there was like Sparks or Cole's notes and things like that where you could get the summaries, but it never quite told you the full story. So you still had to, like, it's like telling kids, you know, I walked to school, there was, you know, in a foot of snow, and, you know, you have no idea what you're talking about. You know, you never walked to school in your life. We'd pick you up and drop you off. Right. Like, so it's things like that. But oh, it's like, oh, here he goes again, you know, like, but when I was bored, you know, I picked up books. I went reading whatever I could find, or I went outside and played, you know, I rode my bike. I went and met up with my friends and you know, when we were at school, we played every, you know, recess was the highlight of school, right? Like getting outside and playing. But now it's like all that's gone away. And anyway, I know this is like a rabbit hole, but it's such an interesting one that you know, we could probably spend the rest of this conversation.
My favorite like anecdote on this is that when I went to high school, we had something called summer reading, where they would assign you reading in at the end of the school year that you had to finish by the time you returned from school, and you were going to get tested on it.
Right.
So I went to like a strong all boys high school. So it's a good high school. It wasn't like your average public school growing up. And we were assigned 7 books going into freshman year. My niece lives like around the corner from me. She goes to one of the top high schools in the country. It's a public school, but it's like one of the top high schools in the country. And they have no summer reading. And that to me is like, I had to read so many books just over the summers. And she looked at me like I had 3 heads. She was like, wait, they give you homework over the summer? Yeah. Right? And I'm like, well, yeah, they made you read books.
She's like, yeah, you were accountable.
Yeah,
you were accountable for it.
Little looked at me like there's just no way that would ever happen.
Yeah.
So
signs of times. Chris, I want to get back to Susquehanna. You got to Susquehanna now. But now what happens? What's the onboarding like there? And I want to ask you about poker, because I know poker was a big deal at Susquehanna.
Yeah.
I watched something you posted, which was a podcast with Jeff Yass that he had granted a high school student, which was really interesting, where he talks about poker. But I you were there, you lived it. What was it like?
Yeah, so they the there's a big emphasis on education and training when you're at SIG. So when you got hired, you basically got put on something like a rotation. You're basically assigned to a trading. This is in my case, I was in New York. They had four offices around the U.S. time, but I was in New York. And so I was placed on the American Stock Exchange, which is where options are traded in New York. There was four exchanges where options were traded in the United States back then. So I was on the Amex in New York. And so you would do your clerical duties during the day. And then after work, you would go up to the office and you would do mock trading and poker. And that was your training.
Right.
And so you would do that for, call it 6 to 9 months. And then you would go to 12-week boot camp at their headquarters in Pennsylvania, where in the boot camp, you just went a lot deeper on everything. But there was also a poker requirement where you needed to play 100 hours of poker over the summer. So every time you played, you would like log your session. And the winner of the 12 weeks would be the person that had the best sharp ratio at the end of the 12 weeks. So they had used poker very much as part of their education. Like, seeing it now, it looks like marketing in some way. Like, it's kind of a neat thing to say, but it was real. Like, they were really into that. There was a company-wide poker tournament there. They've employed many people that have won World Series bracelets and all that stuff. So it's definitely a big part of their culture. But the idea behind poker there is that it's a good game for modeling some of the qualities that you need in trading, because first of all, it's a game, unlike chess, for example. Like, poker is a game of incomplete information,
right?
So whereas chess, you can see all the pieces. In poker, you don't know what everybody's holding. One, you're operating in a situation where you don't have all the information, and people's actions reveal some kind of information by, calling or betting or raising. People's actions reveal something which changes the probabilities. So, you might know the probability of somebody being dealt, a high pair before the flop, but then the way they bet will allow, or bet or not bet, will allow you to sort of like, in what position they're in at the table, will allow you to narrow the range of hands that you think that they might have. So in other words, there was some probability, their action then changes the probability. And this is, they kind of call this like Bayesian updating. And this is what you're doing always in the market. Every time you trade with a counterparty in the market, there's a question of like, I like this trade, but I must like this trade less if somebody's willing to do the other side of it with me, right? Because there's some chance that they know more than I do. So,
right.
When you get dealt your hand, you're like, I like my hand. Well, I like my hand until I get raised. Because the probabilities have updated, like the value of your hand has went down once in the presence of a raise. So that's kind of so there's that whole element. Poker allows you to basically speed run this learning, right? Because you're kind of going, you can do many, many hands and sort of start to get this experience. The other thing that poker does besides provide an information landscape that is similar to the markets is that it teaches you that you can make the right decision and it not work. So everybody has some tedious story of how they had the best hand and, they got sucked out on the river by a flush or something like that and lost a hand at a big pot and like a bad beat story. But the reality is, even a strong hand in poker, as the hand develops, is it could have positive expectancy, but it's low signal at the end of the day, especially with respect to like the range of possible outcomes. And markets are very much like that. You have, you know, if you look at the, you might have a, you're talking about small edges, you know, you're right 51% of the time, that kind of thing. So when you're only right, now if you're right 51% of the time and you manage your risk, you're going to make a lot of money over time. I mean, a casino only has a small edge on the games that they offer.
Right.
Right. But they print money. And, so if you get to play enough times, this is like a pretty good way to become rich. But the problem is that on any one hand is just full of noise. If you're right 51% of the time, it feels like you're losing 50-50, right? So this effectively trains you to deal with a low signal to noise environment. So you become it helps you to not overlearn from winning and losing,
right?
And that's just probably one of the most valuable things that I actually think it gives you, is to the sense of proportion around, you know, if my edge is this small, I can't really learn much from any one outcome. And the whole point of that ultimately is that to not judge your decision quality by what the outcome was. And I think that's like probably the largest value that I think I sort of would have got out of it.
It's fascinating. I think it's hard, like you said, you know, it's hard to contemplate, you know, that 51% of the time, winning 51% of the time is an edge, is the result. You know, it's, you know, if you think I do 100 trades and I only win one more than half of the time, you know, one more time than half of the time, what happens the other 49 times? Like, you know, I know in equities, people have said, you know, if you're right 30 or 40% of the time, you can make a lot of money trading equity, you know, being an equity investor. That's over the long term. But in options, everything is your day-to-day decisions.
Yeah,
how does that 51% translate into, you know, a profitable outcome in options trading? It just seems like such a small edge, like that 1%.
So first of all, it could be less than 51%. You said it right there. You could be, well, here's the thing. Like, if you were right, let's say you were only right 30% of the time, but whenever you were right, you got paid 4-1.
Right.
Like, over time, you're going to make money, right? Because you're going to, you know, if you play five times, you're only going to lose, you're going to lose a dollar on the times that you've lost, but you only lose 30% of the time. You only lose 70% of the time, but you're getting paid 4x, right? So if you play enough times and you're right about these probabilities, it's profitable in the long run to do this. So the issue becomes like, you need to know if you're right about your edge. That's probably one of the biggest risks in any kind of investing situation, is like, are you actually right about your edge? Is your mean expectancy true? Well, this is very hard to know, because if the variation around that is very, very high, you may never get a statistical sample large enough to ever have any confidence that you actually have an edge. So actually, one of the biggest risks.
So you don't have an edge. Yeah, it's the quality of the edge in the first place, right? Like if you have a repeatable edge that you can exercise that has a high probability of winning, Then that's like the first consideration. The second consideration is, once you implement that edge repeatedly, you don't know what the outcome is going to be until you get it. But then, so then a lot of those, like a lot of, like we're talking about, you know, liability matching, right? I mean, in market making, at least, Yeah, and then so if the quality of the edge you're exercising to begin with is a strong edge, like it's grounded, like in terms of how you go about building your trades, so you already have the leg up just by the quality of the edge that you're planning to execute, right? And then if you do that 100 times, most of the time it pans out to nothing, like very small trading gains. But every now and then something comes along like a 4X.
Yeah, and that will tend to, well, that gets into these, like, you get into these topics of like, is the your return stream, for example, you could have a return stream that is, you're making 10% per trade, give or take 5%, let's just say, or give or take 10, that would be an incredibly powerful return stream. So let's say you're making 10%, give or take 30% on any one trial. Sometimes you lose 20%.
Right.
Okay. But you can have a return stream that looks very different than that, where it's like my return stream, it makes 10% on average, but like, it basically loses money 9 times out of 10, and then that 1 time out of 10, it like triples them, it triples its money or whatever math to make it so sort of like average out to 10%. So in that case, that the that the shape of that return stream would change, like how you might have to size it, because you're gonna experience in trying to capture that edge, you're gonna experience these large drawdowns. So you have to be able to tolerate the drawdown. So like the size that you do the trade at depends on how much of a drawdown you can actually experience. Whereas like in the first case where the edge is more symmetrical, to have to be, to have a drawdown where you're down 50% would be incredibly unlikely. So you would not have to hold as much in reserve. So that's kind of like the interplay between risk management and edge, is that like the way you manage risk kind of like is shaped by the way you're like the contours of what your edge looks like. So the overall options trading, I would actually say is probably, it's sure changed over time. Like when you're market making, you tend to win frequently, and then occasionally you basically get run over, and that's because your business is like, I'm buying on the bid, I'm selling on the offer, and then every now and then I bump up on a counter against a counterparty that's information or size is very large, and they run me over and they keep buying, and the
Right.
whole position goes against me. So I get crushed on that one, and then like the situation kind of, so I have a drawdown, the situation is over, go back to like business as usual, and you start making money again. So market making can kind of have that shape, whereas the way I traded as a portfolio manager, so I spent a lot of time on the market making side, but then I spent time as a portfolio manager in options. In that case, the shape could be different, where it's, I'm only right about things, say 30% of the time, but when I'm right, when I hit by a lot, and that was that's just like felt like a different business. Like it was less, it was like you're not making money every single day, and
Right.
you'd have to zoom out and be like, what, I'm okay, if I look at my P&L every day, my job is going to be really, it's going to really weigh on my psyche here, and I shouldn't be looking every day because it's not aligned with the time period in which I'm trying to make money. So you would look more at like, what are my weekly P&Ls? What are my monthly P&Ls? So you get a sense. So it like takes a little longer to converge on like, is my edge aligned with like the time frame in which I'm trading in? Like I said, it's very important always to sort of like think about these things as far as, if you set out to build a business, and you know it's going to take a long time for it to bear fruit, like you wouldn't, you would, it would be obvious to you to not be like concerned about like what's tomorrow's P&L in my business was, because you're like, I know that I'm in the investing phase, the not the harvesting phase, sort of like of that. So, but in trading, it's the same thing. Like whatever your strategy is, you'd want to make sure that you're not looking at information that was irrelevant to what you understand the business to be. So you don't want to, you know, it's kind of like, it's always something that you're dealing with, is like making sure that your dashboards are lined up with like the thing you care about. Like say like Warren Buffett doesn't care about the chart. And if you're an HFT trader, you don't care about the PE ratio. And the moment you start drifting and looking at information that has no relevance to what you understand your job to be, you're getting onto thin ice. You're probably grasping at something.
Interesting. I mean, in market making, you're capturing the spread between bid and ask, right? I mean, essentially,
that's effectively what you're doing. Yeah, it can feel, you know, I think there's a spectrum of speed upon which this is, where you can feel that more. Like if you're super fast, you can probably be like two-sided and make money on both sides. You could be more two-sided back in the days when I started.
Right.
But markets have become a lot tighter over time. I mean, even when I started, when I very first started, they were still quoting in fractions. So your minimum width on an auction, depending on the series, could be 1/16th or 1/8th. So that's, you know, 6.25 cents or 12.5 cents. That is like a comically wide spread today. Imagine like looking at an options market and it was, you know, in a liquid name and all the options are 12.5 cents wide. Like that would, you could drive a truck through that. So since then we've had decimalization, markets are much, much tighter. So now you have to have, you know, before you might have been, you know, I'm $2 bid offered at 210. And now if the market is 206, 207, you can't be on both sides of that. If you think it's worth 205, you're really only on the 207 offer. So market making has turned into something that is, at least on some frequencies, market making has turned into something that is like, you're market making with an axe. Like, yeah, I don't have a two-way market up there, but my real size is on one side. And it's more opinionated market making.
Yeah. So Chris, how was your, thank you. I mean, I think I understand. Talk about your experience in the trading pits in New York and how did you eventually, like what are the series of events that sort of led you to end up in the portfolio management side of the business eventually?
Yeah. So I did a lot of different floor trading jobs when I was in New York. So a great thing about SIG was they're pretty entrepreneurial. So I was an assistant. First of all, I started as an assistant. So that was in index options mostly. It was in ETFs. Actually, I was my first job ever at SIG was I was a clerk in the SPY ETF itself, not the options, just the ETF.
Oh, wow.
So I worked for a trader who stood in the SPY trading pit. Believe it or not, it's like people would, you know, there was a trading pit for it and on the Amex for the actual ETF. And I clerked for him and then I did index option stuff. And then after that, when I was trading my own account, I started in equity options. I spent maybe 2 years doing that. And then I went back to ETFs. And then after that, after the ETF stint, I went to, I was asked to go start the oil options business on the NYMEX floor. And that was a giant transition because now I'm going from equities to commodity futures. Went over to that building and we built a business trading options there. So you go in the pit there that when I first started there was not The only electronic aspect of it was at night there was a system called Access, and you could trade the futures at night electronically, but during the day there was no electronic market at all. So everything was traded in the pit.
It's wild.
The futures and the options. Right. Totally crazy. So I was in the options pit. It was, you know, 100 people in that pit. And then the futures pit, which was way bigger, was, you know, 50 feet away from you. So you would do your options trades, and then you would have to yell over to like a point clerk that was standing near the futures pit and flash them your order for how many futures you wanted to buy or sell to hedge your options trade. And then pretty shortly after I went over there, the electronic markets started to emerge and gain liquidity and all that stuff. And, you know, eventually getting to what it looks like today. But so I had traded oil. Then I had moved over, traded gasoline, traded heating oil. I kept doing this stuff until 2008. That's when I left SIG. And
right.
And then at that point, I went over to trade. So I couldn't trade oil related products because I had a non-compete with SIG that prohibited me from doing that. So when I left, I got a backer. It basically allows you to like start your own trading business. And I traded natural gas options because I was not prohibited from trading those. So I was like, okay, what can I trade in this building? And that was right in front of me. So I did that. I did that for a couple of years, and then I moved over, and then the natural gas business started getting a lot worse. Basically, the volatility in that market had collapsed because of all this supply that we were able to get from shale. All the horizontal drilling and all the sponsors is totally changed the marketplace. So it killed the volatility, increased the supply. We're swimming in the stuff. So there was no reason to have as many market makers in something that is a 40, you know, moves around at 40% a year rather than 80% a year. So I left that, started trading gold and silver, and then cotton, coffee. And at this point, this is like getting around 2011, and I realized at this point I had like traded many, many different things. And that was where I had gotten the desire to say, you know, I don't like this experience of if you trade just one thing and it dies, you just feel homeless. So and I said, what I would like to do is be able to have a bird's eye view of all the commodity markets and all of their option markets and just jump in wherever the action was. Because there's always, you know, as I like to say, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. There's always some market where it's going crazy. So if you have the infrastructure to see everything, you can just focus on what's going crazy and, you know, not get bogged down in something that's like edgeless, boring, like there's not much going on in it. So that was, but to do that, I started to build a prototype of a database for that. Like we hired some kid and started doing that at when I was still back by myself. But then I realized like to do this right, we were going to need proper developer resources. We were going to need, it was going to be a pretty big upfront expenditure to do it properly. So that was when Parallax happened to be right around the time that Parallax reached out to me and said, you know, we're kind of dabbling in commodity stuff, but it's not our expertise. Would you be interested in moving to California and build a business in that for us? And that was exactly what I was wanted to do. I mean, it was like that. I had that vision, and so I kind of was like, yeah, funny you mentioned that. And then I put together a pitch deck of like what I wanted to build and presented it to them. And, you know, I was in California 6 months later. So that was, and when I got there, that was exact, you know, I basically followed through on the plan. Like, this is the things I wanted to do. We built out a lot of infrastructure, was able to work with some fantastic technologists and, you know, the thing that we wanted. And then, you know, took about a year of building, and then I was able to start trading everything.
It's funny, like, no, I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, you uprooted yourself completely from, you know, East Coast, from New York, and went to California. I mean, That's a whole other thing, right?
You know, my wife is from California, so her family's here, and I had always wanted to live in California anyway. I grew up in New Jersey, I was living in New York City after that, and you know, I'm Egyptian, I don't like cold weather. So I had wanted to move to California since I was 21. Like I had after my first vacation that I took at SIG, I just went and visited my college friends that had moved out to Silicon Valley. They were engineers and they had moved out to Silicon Valley and, you know, chasing.com and all that. And I came and spent a week with them. They were living in Cupertino at the time, and it was like a scene right out of that TV show, Silicon Valley, like a house like that and everything. And I was like, you know, I remember like your pool parties and like all that. I was like, this is for me. I like this. And then, you know, but I didn't get out to California. It took me more than a decade later to actually move out here to California.
Amazing. Amazing. And how did your stint at Parallax work out?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was awesome. They were, you know, they were amazing partners on building that business because, you know, they gave me a tremendous amount of autonomy. They gave me resources as far as, you know, access to technologists and you know, they really understand options trading. I mean, they're the oldest options focused hedge fund in America. So, and their CIO is a former SIG trader as well. So it's they understand options deeply. And so, and I think that's really, I mention that because there are a lot of people that try, there are a lot of businesses that try to get into options and they don't have like a great understanding of what that business actually looks like. Like they think to themselves like, oh, if we do options, we're going to either they're coming to it because they're like, oh, if we do options, we're going to be able to make steady income by selling premium. Or they come at it from the other perspective and they think, oh, if we do options, we're going to be able to buy all this like really cheap protection or something like that. And we're going to make money. And every time the S&P goes down, we're going to make boatloads of money and it's going to be great. And the reality is like the shape of an options P&L book is quite complicated. There are so many moving parts. There are so many, you know, the number of line items in your portfolio is gigantic. Actually understanding what your risk is non-trivial. So unless you are sort of like a dyed-in-the-wool options trader, it's very easy for there to be a misalignment between somebody trying to acquire an options business and not understanding what they're getting into. I mention this because I see this a lot. Like I've seen this a lot with like people that I know that are options traders that, you know, they rightfully think like, you know, if I go and I join this other organization, it's going to be a great fit because they're non-overlapping, right? They're like, oh, I'm going to be very valuable in this other organization because I'm completely complementary, which is like, generally speaking, that's a great way to like raise your value. Like you might be somewhat commoditized in the industry that you're actually in because there's lots of replacements for you. And you go into a business that needs somebody like you and you think, oh, this is going to maximize my value, and then you show up and then you basically discover that everybody's expectations of one another are not what you thought. That story happens a lot, and it's kind of I've seen that happen quite a bit. So there was just no issues like that with Parallax. They understood this business you know, perfectly, really. Yeah, I was able to build without feeling like I was on any kind of a short leash, had latitude. And that's the right way to be able to build something. Like you need to have, if you have the pressure to build, like I need to make money tomorrow, it's hard to build something really large if you're going to just be concerned about tomorrow all the time. So, Yeah, they had an investing mindset about what we were building. And so they were great partners. And I spent a decade there before deciding, you know, sitting in front of, I wanted to, you know, try something else besides waking up at 4 a.m. every day and trading the markets.
Yeah, that's kind of cool that you ended up at Parallax, you know, where there was a common understanding, a common knowledge between you already because of the connection, right?
Yeah, I just think it's options trading is hyper specialized. Like we were off camera, we were talking before, saying that, you know, to the point where, you know, there was a period of time. I mean, I've definitely went through a period of time where I felt very uneasy about my professional choices because, you know, I did realize at some point, you know, you realize, you know, before you quit, you know that you want to quit, right? Like it take like, you know, a couple years in advance of quitting, I'm already thinking like, yeah, I'm just kind of wondering what else is out there in life. You know, it's like this has been a long time to be doing one thing. And what happens is if you're super specialized, you start to think that the world is very that there's nothing for you out there because you know, your resume is filled with words that are meaningless to anybody that's not in your field. So you have to in some ways, specialization is great because you develop a deep expertise at something. The number of people that, you know, in the world that know what you know is fairly small. But at the same time, if you want to change, it's very hard to go anywhere. So, there's a big trade-off in being hyper-specialized. And I certainly felt hyper-specialized.
That's very interesting. I mean, off camera, you know, I shared with you that you know, I even after being an advisor for 15 years and dealing with clients every day and their portfolios, I realized a year after I had sold my book and moved on that I knew virtually nothing about the bond market. That I thought that I did. I believed that I knew something about it, but I realized in the vastness of it all that really, I, you know, compared to my knowledge compared to what there was to know was nearly zero, right? And the same goes with options. My personal knowledge of options and options trading is, I would say, it's nearly zero compared to yours, compared to what there is to know in the options market. And so I appreciate that. I think you know, you if you spend your, you know, if you spend your life doing something very highly specialized, it's only after you stop doing it that you realize, wait, there's so much more out there. There's so many other things, so many things that I never looked at or never paid attention to, right? So you I feel like, you know, I feel like you've sort of, like, you since founded Moontower.ai, and you've been, you also started your Moontower Substack.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, going through it, I feel like, you know, you're reflecting a lot on the things that you came to know, that you learned about markets, about life. It's really a great, you know, a great sort of like reveal from you. It's very honest. It's very candid. It's interesting because, you know, you're taking your experience in options trading and translating it into life. Like, you get into, you know, you talk about probabilities and understanding, you know, probabilistic thinking and prediction markets, which have really, you know, become, you know, come to the forefront in the last couple of years. What do you hope people make? Like, well, first of all, what is Moontower?
Yeah, so the Moontower AI is an option analytics platform. So we it's basically, I call it it's very opinionated. We have because it's using a lens that I used when I was a portfolio manager. So it's trying to say, most people when they use options, they're using them for they're using them for direction. They're selling options because they're trying to earn some a premium, or they want to bet on direction in a levered way. And the challenge there is that the value of an option is highly dependent on not only on this number called volatility, and it's dependent on how much the asset is going to move, not just the direction it's going to move in exactly. So what happens is people are trading options without a great understanding of the thing that drives its value. You know, if you don't have an opinion about volatility, then you should probably just trade the stock itself, because it gives you the directional output, the directional exposure that you're looking for. If you use options and you don't understand how volatility works, well, you might end up being right on a direction and still losing. So the having an understanding of the options helps you to evaluate, is options the right tool for the job? And so what our tool does is kind of give you some sense of which options we think are relatively cheap, which ones we think are relatively expensive. And you may come to it and decide like, hey, I've looked at this analysis and this is the options I want to use. Or you may come to this and say, actually, it turns out I was going to do this options trade, but after looking at this, I've decided I don't want to do the option. I don't want to do an options trade. And that's valuable too, to stop you from a trade that you would have otherwise have done. So that's it's an options platform that very simply, I think of it as an educational and useful lens for making better decisions about your options trades.
Excellent. I mean, it's a tool that investors and advisors could use in order to help them make decisions about one, you know, using options one way or another.
That's right.
You've actually spent a lot of time talking about how, you know, you've said that the options market is the true underlying market. And I think you just said it in another way just now, which is that, you know, the value of options is determined by the value of the assets they're priced against. Like for equities, you know, you have strike prices that are based on whatever the stock is trading. But one of the most interesting things that I think you bring up is what the option chain can tell you about any given stock. And you've got a sort of very handy way of explaining it. And I think that's valuable.
Yeah. So I'll use the example I always give, because it's fairly simple to understand. And I think it just demonstrates the point really well. But if you look at two stocks and both of them are $100, like all we see is $100 stock, but we don't, that $100, and if you think of $100, that's like the discounted present value of like future cash flows, like the whole, you know, finance 101 spiel. But the question is like, not $200 stocks could be $100 for very different reasons. You could have one stock as $100 because, and I'm just going to use binary examples, meaning that there's only two possibilities. The $100 stock could be $100 because it's 50% to go to $80 and 50% to go to $120. So its current value would be $100, and that would be a fair price for the stock because it's 50-50 to be 80 or 120. Another stock will also be $100. You pull up the ticker and it also says $100. But that $100 is distributed very differently. Maybe that stock has a 20% chance of being worth $500, and it will have an 80% chance of being worth zero. So in other words, it could be the kind of stock that's entire future depends on some like FDA ruling, for example, just some pivotal event that is going to determine the entire value of this company. Both of these stocks are $100, but they are completely different in their risk. And the options market would reveal to you what the shape of these underlying distributions actually is, because what will happen is in the case of the first stock, $100 stock, the 200 strike call will have no value because there's no chance of this stock going above $200. You can go to 120. The 200 call will have no value at all. The second option the 200 call will be, well, we'll look at it this way. If the stock were to go to 500, the 200 call would be $300 in the money. It would be worth $300 at expiration. And we said there's a 20% chance of that happening. So there's a 20% chance that this option is worth $300. So that call option today must be worth $60. And so you got both of these stocks, and in one of them, the 200 call is worth $60. And in the other example, the other stock, the 100 call is worth zero. And it turns out that if you looked at all the option strike prices in you can actually map out what the distribution of the stock is that is implied in the marketplace. So there's a lot of technicalities that kind of go into that and like what those probabilities actually mean. But overall, the options market is giving you a three-dimensional understanding of a company, whereas the stock price itself is just, you know, it's cardboard. It's two-dimensional.
Yeah, that's incredibly valuable information if you're trying to make a long-term decision about, first of all, investing in a stock, but secondly, using options as a way of either enhancing or reducing risk.
You have a view about a company that differs from what the market's view is on the company, then there is a great chance that you're going to find an option that is attractive to you one way or the other, because these options are heavily dependent upon what these assumptions about volatility and the distribution actually are. And that's, so the right way to express a differing opinion about sort of the shape of the distribution could be the options. You know, it could be, you know, you might, for example, I'll give you an example. Like, you might say to yourself, you know, I don't have, you're like, I think that the stock is probably reasonably priced, but if this deal that this company does happens, like this partnership with some other company happens, I think that the upside in this company is probably a lot more than is expected, but I don't have necessarily a strong opinion about the stock in the absence of that deal happening. So what happens is you have a very conditional point of view, and the right way to express that trade, it would be way too low resolution or blunt to just go buy the stock, because that deal is only happening in like a small percentage of the scenarios. So you want to isolate your bet to it being conditional upon that deal happening, right? So what happens is, like, in that case, what you might say is the stock seems like it's fairly priced, but the calls look too cheap, because in this outlier scenario, this stock's worth a lot more than what sort of like what the market thinks. But I don't know how likely that scenario is. And I'm certainly don't have enough confidence to just buy the stock, because maybe this deal only happens 10% of the time.
But once you start, I mean, that can very much help you to realize what the actual problem, not what your guessed probability is, but what the actual statistical probability is of something happening, what the market thinks, like with all the information that's available, as opposed to, you know, any one of us just sort of guessing, yeah, that'll probably happen. Is it a 50-50 guess it'll probably happen, or is it 80-20? Is it 80% yes it'll happen, or right? I mean, that's where predictive markets obviously are becoming a bigger and bigger part of the market, is because they help, they're going to help us understand what the actual probability is, not what, or closer to what the actual probability is of something happening versus an anecdotal guess.
Right.
Or in a pit, you know.
This is like, I think this is a topic that's going to become more and more and more common. People are going to learn more and more about this. But I'll just tell a little story, because it's a little bit of a fun one. But when I was when we were in training, I remember the example that was given to us about, like, you know, the view on markets as a, if there's many ways that we could sort of like glean information about like people's preferences and or what reality is, right? So we can have people vote, That's a way of coordinating our behavior, right? That's the that's democracy. And then there's market. There's markets are way another way of like aggregating consensus. So the example that was kind of given to us was this was kind of like based upon some like poll that happened. Again, this is like over 30 years ago. But the question was, did humans walk the earth at the same time as dinosaurs? And that poll comes out like 50-50. Right. And the point was, if there was a prediction market based upon like, hey, we're going to reveal the evidence or something like that on this, like the contract would trade close to zero. There's no, because there's the people that understand carbon dating, like the scientists that understand carbon dating and all those kinds of things that kind of like, you know, pulling up fossils from the ground. They're going to show the evidence and be like, yeah, that's we're not even close. That never happened. And so the market price would be a lot closer to the truth than if you just ask people. And if a market is functioning in a healthy way, there's like a diversity of actors and, you know, because there's a wisdom of markets and obviously there's the insanity of markets. So, you know, tulip manias and these things, like if everybody starts thinking the exact same way, you can get bubbles, you can get an unhealthy market. So, right. But so there's a lot of, there's a lot of like, what do you call it? Disclaimers on markets. I'm not saying that there isn't, but in general, if a market is healthy, it does a better job of finding the truth than just asking people. And so, that's the prediction market. The advocates of prediction markets are excited about this because the ability to have, you know, if prediction markets can become healthy and liquid, I mean, that's the key. It's like, are we going to get liquidity and are there the right conditions for them to gather liquidity? These are all like open questions, I would say. But if they were to get liquidity and become healthy markets, instead of, you know, wondering like, what is the net impact on our budget of this new thing coming out? There could be a market that would be your better guess than you or I sticking our finger in the air and wondering. And we're already used to this. We already believe this to some degree. Like if I told you, if I asked you, hey, the CEO of this company just resigned. Is this good or bad for the stock? Like you might sit there and search for like your opinion, be like trying to think, but like, yeah, you wouldn't really do that. What you would do is you would just go look at the stock price and be like, well, the stock's up 10% after hours. It looks like the market thinks that CEO destroyed a lot of value, right?
Right.
The fact that you would even have the reflex to go look at the market tells me that you're already conditioned to understand that the market has some truth value embedded in it and that you're not going to rely on yourself to form an opinion here.
Well, that's like saying I'm right and everyone else is wrong too, right? I mean, if you like consider what I like is the pair of just to pull on a thread of what we just talked about, which is that the options chain of any given stock can tell you the same kind of information as prediction markets can. Which is what do the majority of, you know, what does all the information translate into? Is it good or bad? Is the outlook that does the outlook that the options chain tells me is in the future the same as what I believe? Or is it different? And if it's different, then I should question it. I should look at it closer and say, is this the right decision? Do I want how much? And then size that, you know, if I'm going to go ahead with that decision, I can decide how much to size it. Right.
Yeah. Like 100%. It's just like at the end of the, like, I, you know, it's so simple, but like
how much risk am I taking?
Right. It's just like the sports betting markets already. Right. It's like, it's one thing to know that, you know, hey, is Oklahoma City going to win tonight? Well, they're probably going to win, but you know, what probability would you assign to it? And the betting market will tell you, right? Like you can see what the money line is going to be and you can figure out what the probability is. And it's not enough you know, having an advantage in making money is, it's not enough to know what's going to happen. You have to know what's going to happen at the right odds. You have to, in other words, like you have to beat the spread. Yeah, you know, you have to beat the line. And, you know, if you're walking around in your life thinking everybody's stupid, you are entitled to do that. But then I would expect that you are insanely rich. Yeah. There's no way to reconcile. You think you're right about everything, but you're not insanely rich, because you would find all kinds of things to trade against if you really are that much better. If you're, all of your opinions are better than replacement value, then you should be very, very rich.
Right. And consequently, like if you're an investor advisor weighing an investment option, and you know, those folks are telling you that they've got some remarkable edge in the market, and you know, you should invest with them. Another way to look at that is if you've got such a great edge in the market, then why do you need me?
100%. I mean, this is
right.
If you, you know, I don't think it's an accident that all of these extremely high Sharpe ratio market making firms and trading firms, they're all private. They don't want your money.
Yeah.
Right. It's like,
exactly. They're not all for it.
They're not out here offering you their returns, you know, like,
yeah.
So this is all private capital that is built on private edges. And, you know, what they don't want is to be giving up their returns to anybody on the, you know, if you think about a hedge fund, they have to give 80% of their profits over to their LPs.
Yeah.
Right. But a private, you know, at least, you know, maybe even more than 80% these days. You know, but those private trading firms, it's like, they're not giving anything away to their LPs.
Amazing. I mean, it's neat to actually reflect on the amount of learning that there is left, you know, available to us on, you know, how to make better decisions. Chris, what I know, you know, we're caught. I wish we had more time because I had so many more questions. I hope we can continue on another episode. What advice would you give today's either college graduates or other folks who are thinking of getting into trading?
I think that if you're, well, I will just, I don't know if it's so much advice versus telling them the reality of it, which is that if you're trying to get into trading, my understanding now is that here's the big difference between when I was getting into it and now. When I was getting into trading, it was the, you know, like sort of like the redheaded stepchild. Like it was not a high status job to go into that. It was paid way less than going into banking. Like banking was the thing, that was a thing everybody wanted to do if they wanted to go into finance, and trading was relatively like backwater. This is completely different now. I saw a high school kid in my town not too long ago that had a James Street t-shirt on. Okay, like the cat's out of the bag,
right?
These are the most profitable firms in the world on a per employee basis. That means that, and those firms are in a gigantic talent war trying to hire the same people that an OpenAI or Google is trying to hire, because all those skill sets have converged on this like incredibly highly technical abilities. So what's happened now is that they are going lower and lower into the age groups to try to get a leg up in the talent war. So high school kids are now being exposed to seminars where they're sponsored by these companies. Every college is sort of like in the mix with that. So this is the reality of it is, you have to get your technical chops have to be absolutely top tier, because the kids that, the people that are motivated to want to go into this field, the field pays a tremendous amount of money for a first year person, probably more than any other job you can get. And so the competition is intense, is global. And my advice to you, at least, as I hope you're listening to this when you're very young, because You're going to need to, if you're serious about wanting to go into trading specifically, there's going to be kids that have been preparing for years by the time they're 20. So, and now the right way is to get an internship. Like the big thing that, and this wasn't true back then, but like now all these companies offer internships. The way in is to get an internship while you're in college and then hope that that translates to an offer for a first year job. So that is specifically if you're interested into going into trading, just realize that it's now it's hyper competitive. It's not what it was 30 years ago because everybody knows about it now. So if you want to, and otherwise, if you want to go into finance, I in general, maybe not trading, but I would say that it's sort of the same playbook as wanting to, if you want to do anything, like you have to pursue your curiosity with tenacity. You have to stand out. We're in a world, I understand very, I hear now that it's these stories of, you know, I've sent a resume to 100 places and it's the same way with college. You apply to 100 colleges and you try to get into the one you want. Like it, everything is very, we're in a very big rejection culture, lots of attempts and very low hit rates. And I would encourage people to think about more, probably being more strategic about that. If everybody is scattershot, then you probably need to think of a way to focus on exactly where you want to be. And then take all the energy you took shooting a shotgun at everything else and take all that energy and focus it into a narrower pool of companies. Try to be creative. How can I back channel my way in there? Never give up. And because your hope is that, you know, somebody sees something in you that says, you know what, this person is just switched on. They really,
right.
I'm not getting the same energy about this person's attempt to come here that I am from all these people where I'm just like one firm out of many firms, or I'm just one group out of many groups. This person seems to really want to be here. And I think demonstrating that would be, it is a strategy. I think taking the replacement level strategy of just shooting everybody, then that's only going to work if you are absolutely ridiculous on paper. I just don't
see, yeah.
And like, unless you're really ridiculous, then, you're just going to need to figure out another strategy, which is just a metaphor for all things in life. I mean, if you just do the replacement level thing, you're going to get replacement level results.
Excellent advice, Chris. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that. Chris, we're out of time. I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been just a sheer pleasure talking to you.
I appreciate it, Pierre. Thanks for having me on.